Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen. I'm back. Hello.
And this week,
we talk about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Again, sorry.
We talk about new centrist parties.
And we talk about Brexit because we kind of feel like we have to.
So the boys are back in town.
Am I the boys? Is that what you're saying? Hello. It's really nice to be back. I have a confession, which is that I did kind of cheat on the New Statesman podcast with two other podcasts while I was away. I went on the Romaniacs podcast, and then I did one that isn't out yet that was just basically a podcast where people asked me questions about myself for an hour.
So you had time to do other podcasts, but not here in our glamorous bunker.
I think you did really well without me. You didn't need me. You moved on. But anyway, it's kind of the New Statesman podcast to take me back. And I wondered if this week we could talk a little bit about let's take the opportunity to have a recap, maybe, of the last couple of months. What have I missed?
Well, actually, so I would be intrigued by, while you were on your, like, you know, in your ranch, thinking big thoughts for your book, what's the publisher of the book?
Jonathan Cape.
Jonathan Cape. I just feel like, seeing as you're going to start doing that all the time, I should ease the listeners into it now.
Yeah. All good bookshops.
Yeah.
2019/20, depending on whether or not I managed to file it on time. But I think the thing that you always notice when you take a bit of time off politics, and actually I had this conversation with my parents who've just returned from 4 months in the Southern Hemisphere, is how little changes. When you're living in the middle of it, it seems like this incredibly overwhelmingly frothy, like, micro developments. And if you go and do the Sunday shows or anything like that, then you have to not only know the current positions of everybody, but every previous past position that they've moved through, right? Which in the case of something like the Corbyn anti-Semitism rally, you just need to have the timeline absolutely nailed down. But when you actually look at, like, what's different, what has actually changed, if it were a play and you were trying to look at what the protagonists, like, what have they learned, how have they changed, what, you know, what synthesis have you achieved at the end of this, it's often absolutely nothing. Like, where was we with Brexit at the end of January compared to now? Exactly the same place, I swear.
Well, we've now agreed a transition period.
What, which we knew that we were going to want because it was the only way for us to go, please give us more time to make this work.
Okay, right. Because I would say that in the time you've gone, Theresa May has become more secure. The long-running concerns within the community about Labour and anti-Semitism have exploded back into, I was going to say, national consciousness. I don't think that's true, but they've been covered in Westminster, at least.
But again, and how new are they? This is the thing that's really interesting, is those concerns aren't new, right? They date back to at least 2016, when the Chakrabarti report failed to kind of settle the issue. And actually, really, to the first time the Jewish Chronicle asked about that mural, yeah, was 2015.
The seven questions or six questions or...
Yeah.
There were questions and there were more than five of them.
And I don't know, do you think that Jeremy Corbyn's relationship with the sort of mainstream Jewish leadership organisations has moved on significantly at the end of this week compared to where it was at the end of the, you know, immediate aftermath of the Chakrabarti report? An awful lot has happened to get to exactly the same place, as far as I can see.
Yeah, okay, so it's a good question. My instinct is, so I think the significant change in terms of Jeremy Corbyn's relationship with majority opinion in the community has probably, I think, actually, also, though he will now meet with the Jewish Leadership Council and Board of Deputies, both of whom have dropped their preconditions after Corbyn agreed to their agenda. Jenny Formby will attend. I think that his...
Oh, so Labour have got a new General Secretary. That is new.
That is new, yeah. his relationship with the majority opinion in the Jewish community, I do not think is likely to improve all of that much, for a variety of reasons, some of which are to do with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, some of which are to do with Israel, some of which are to do with... I think he was well within his rights to go to a seder with his allies on the Jewish left in his constituency. However, I also think it is reasonable for people on the Board of Deputies, people in the community, to interpret that as a bit of a two-fingered salute to some of their feelings about the demonstration. However, I think crucially, you know, ultimately, if you look at the history of Gentiles waiting for them to vote in the interest of the Jewish people, you will look a long time. Crucially, I think what has happened is I suspect he has done enough to reassure people who aren't in the community that his heart is in the right place on these issues. So
yeah, it's very fine to explain. I went on the Today programme to talk about this and I was like, well, this is a kind of classic Jeremy Corbyn insider-outsider dichotomy, right? Which has been the issue all along in his leadership is that people who follow these stories incredibly closely end up with a different view to the people who just see the big picture. And if you try to explain to someone who's not really massively up on any of these things to say, Jeremy Corbyn went to a Seder, went to a Passover celebration meal with a group of Jewish people after a week in which he was criticised for not listening enough to Jewish people. People go, well, that sounds great. Well done. Good job. And you have to go into quite a fine level of detail to say, well, the thing is that, you know, Judas are a legitimate group. They're entitled to opinion. They're often very hyperbolic and very satirical. But, you know, they are firmly within the community. They have done work to combat anti-Semitism. Nonetheless, it does feel like, as you say, you're picking the group of people who already, as you wrote, you're picking a group of people who essentially are your comfort zone, who already agree with you, when the specific demand of you has been that you make yourself uncomfortable by listening to other people. But I have no hope of communicating that ever to anybody who's not following this story, to be honest.
However, the kind of question that I ended up not being able to pose in my column this week is because I could not make it within the word count. I could not introduce it, explain it, and dispatch it in a way that wasn't inelegant.
But can I interject and say the thing that was quite sweet about your column was finding out that because you're the only grandchild of your generation, you always got to ask the questions in your Passover?
Yeah, that may actually be why I am the way I am.
This is really sweet. Just imagine like baby Stephen being like, why is this night not like other nights?
Why do we lean to the left? And why do we only have unleavened bread? But anyway, the crucial issue, yeah, it is very much not true when people say, are you saying this is anti-Semitic? You actually mean it is anti-Israel. But for a large number of people in the community, support for Israel is hugely important because although people wouldn't actually want to go there, they like the idea that it exists as a safe place than they could theoretically go, and support for it is kind of a signal that people get their values. I basically think that Jeremy Corbyn is never going to want to be or be able to reach that group. However, what he can do, and I think he is now starting to, is to do enough to have merely as fraught a relationship with the Jewish community as Ed Miliband did.
Yeah, I went back through the cuts, actually, because I thought I'm going to really see whether or not how much criticism he did get. And the thing is, Ed Miliband comes from a Jewish background himself, and I was very kind of, I think, very clear about his criticisms of Israel. But he supported Palestinian statehood. He was very critical of Israel over the Gaza war in 2014. And you know what? He did come in for a lot of criticism from places like the Jewish Chronicle that are quite... it's frankly hawkish on those things. You know, so there is going to be unless, you know, Labour leaders dramatically change their stance towards Israel, they will definitely get criticised by some bits of the community that are just hawkish.
Well, I also think it's not even just about being critical. So my grandfather, which, as you know, I wrote a bit in the column, we never really talked about Israel other than once after the very small synagogue in Lusaka in Zambia, an argument between some liberal American from an NGO and someone from the Israeli embassy who my grandfather always liked to claim to me was in fact secretly the head of Mossad in sub-Saharan Africa. I have no idea if he actually thought this was true or if he just liked and it annoyed my mother to claim this. But they had this argument about the state of Israel and its various policies. As you would expect, the liberal American was against and the possible Mossad agent was for. he kind of said nothing and kind of sort of broke up. And afterwards in the car, he kind of turned to me and said, God, Israel's a bore, isn't it? But I think the reason why that was true for him is that the community he grew up in England trained him to be a medical professional, and you know he married out without being the subject of an aggressive or racist reaction. And the community he made a home in Zambia, he was a respected pillar of both the Jewish and non-Jewish community. So the idea and appeal of Israel of somewhere you would want to flee to had no salience to him. So I don't think it's even about, because you're right, the JC is very much the most hawkish of the various Jewish publications. It's not even, I think, about that level of hawkishness. It's for a large number of people, it's kind of like, I suppose it's the same level of reassurance and knowing that a politician thinks Stop and Search was abused before 2014 has for a lot of black voters. It's just a sign that, okay, you get what I'm worried about. And I think...
Don't you think Trident falls into that as well? Like, I don't think that the vast majority of people in this country want to immolate people in a nuclear firewall, but there are, for whom a lot of people, that says that's a way of saying that I take Britain's defence really seriously. I think we're a big boy, we're playing at the table. Like, it's a signal. I also think the thing that I didn't understand until a couple of years ago, because, you know, I grew up in the Midlands where, you know, Britain's Jewish population is extremely small and highly concentrated in London. So that's another reason why I think you were talking about people voting on the basis of this. For lots of people, this is a very abstract kind of argument. And the thing that I don't think I'd clocked until recently is the idea of the intense double standard about Israel. And you hear these tropes on the left all the time about, you know, this is a stolen land. And you don't hear them in mainstream discourse about America, which is just as equally a kind of stolen land from the Native Americans, right? I think that there is an idea that there is a kind of the idea that Israel should be held to some higher standard, that actually we don't acknowledge all our own endless histories of colonialism and oppression.
Yeah, and I think that is definitely an aspect of anti-Semitism, which is holding Israel to a higher standard. Equally, the United States, for all of its faults as a settler nation, did not shoot any protesters this week.
No, but it did massacre, on the Trail of Tears, hunt thousands and thousands of Native Americans. I think that's the thing that's interesting. Yeah, and you're right to raise that, because I think one thing that I think people are reluctant to just, not even to, it's not that thing of, I don't want to criticise Israel in case I get accused of anti-Semitism. It's, I don't want to criticise Israel because this, I know that it's like my equivalent of putting my hand in a wasp's nest, right? I think it's just one of those subjects that people know they don't want to be involved in, and actually not having an opinion is kind of safer. But you're right, we should be incredibly, it's a very right-wing government. It's, you know, propped up by even further right-wing elements of their coalition partners, and very nationalist. And I think that what we've done in our leader column this week is we've done two separate leaders, right? We've done a leader that's about Labour and anti-Semitism, and we've done a leader about Gaza and what Israel's doing there, and about the fact they should cooperate with an independent investigation. I think it's much more hygienic to keep the two separate as you can, but it's not always possible.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty, one of the things I found maddening in some of the responses to my free morning email.
That's still going, then. That hasn't changed in 2 months.
That hasn't changed in 2 months. And you actually can now sign up again.
Hey!
Yeah. So that is something that has changed.
Yeah.
Something has been fixed on the IT.
Yeah.
When I've written about it and you get a reply about, isn't this just about criticising Israel? And it's one of those things where I both find it deeply depressing from a personal reason, but from a professional perspective, I find it deeply... I feel I have clearly failed somewhere if there are people who are reading my email who don't understand that, like, I actually cannot work out how you get from Netanyahu is an obstacle to peace. Actually, I don't even get how you get from, I don't think that Israel should have been created. I don't even get how you get from that quite maximal position to the Holocaust was faked. And I do not understand the fact that a large number of people on the left seem to believe that this question of, like, but how can you say one without somehow lapsing into the other? I mean, they're not, I don't, what are even the degrees of separation?
Yeah, you're right. One of them is a political opinion, which can be wrong. The other is an argument with the concept of facts themselves.
Yeah. But, so yeah, okay, I guess that one hasn't changed that much, although
I think your Theresa May thing is interesting, because I saw in one of your morning emails, because I signed up before the problems began to plague the sign-up process, that you were saying, you could even see a situation in which Theresa May might lead the Tories into the next election. And that, like, 6 months ago, that would have seemed like a wacko opinion. I'd have been phoning in to check that you hadn't just accidentally eaten something you'd left out in the fridge for 3 weeks before writing that.
So I think there are a couple of reasons why that is the case. The first is that no one wants to get rid of her before Brexit is finished.
But do you know what this has got a terrible echo of? Let's hang on to Nick Clegg and dump all the toxicity on him and then get rid of him just before the election and then the Lib Dems will be fine. And guess what? Narrator, they did not dump Nick Clegg before the election. It was not fine.
Well, this thing is, so let's say in the London elections, the local elections, it feels likely to me that Labour will take control of Swindon, maybe, you know, win Tamworth on the day. It's all up, so it's up in thirds. I mean, so it's quite hard for them to take control, but I can see how, you know, win it on the day, as it were. Wins Wandsworth, wins Westminster. All of those things seem to me quite likely from the very unscientific metric of I went there and knocked on some doors and went, hey, how do you feel about politics, guys? That is as bad as it can basically get from a local election perspective. They're obviously not going to get rid of her this year. They're not going to get rid of her next year, when in any case, I actually suspect, partly because of the unwinding of UKIP, actually the pretext will probably be quite thin.
Hey, UKIP raised whatever it was, £370,000. They're not bankrupt. Also, they're not apparently
going to
have
they're not financially bankrupt.
Yes, that's very true. In terms of ideas, I'm afraid. And I kind of felt when Gawain Towler, their long-running press aide, left, I sort of felt that was like the ravens leaving the Tower of London.
I felt more like the tower leaving the tower, to be honest. Like, there's just a raven just in a hole in London.
Yeah.
Just being like, God, I swear when I went to bed this morning, there was a building around me. Yeah, it is. I mean, the fascinating thing is, in general, the problem than the nativist right has had is that the demand among voters has been higher than the ability of nativist parties to get their act together and actually appeal to them has been, right? They have tended to, you know, they've tended to be a supply side rather than a demand side problem. Whereas the problem, of course, of new parties of the left under New Labour and new parties of the centre under Corbyn is very much a demand side problem. But there is a multiplicity of supply.
Should we stop then? Then should we come back to the new centrist party? Because while I've been away, of course, multiple new centrist parties have been founded and we live in their shadow today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us! Do you know what? I just remember what I thought on the way home last night. I thought that I was going to celebrate being back by doing the Eminem rap about being back, but I'm not. I'm going to spare you that. If people want to hear that, they should write in.
Please don't write in.
It was going to be really good. I can remember it all. I did it myself to myself on the way home last night. It's great.
Wow. So the research time was used well. anyway, so we do have a question from Rachel. Should there be a new centrist party and should David Miliband lead it?
Yes, from one Rachel S. in London. Yeah, so Rachel Sylvester, the Times columnist, wrote, I think maybe even used the word saviour. And this was really funny. This was the most outpouring of bile that I've seen among kind of political correspondents since, oh, what's his name with the spider? Gavin Williamson.
Yeah.
And then everyone just went, oh my God, we hate Gavin Williamson. You know, and the FT ran that report of just people just calling him the C word and all sorts. And you were like, whoa, okay, people, I didn't realise that you felt so strongly. Anyway, it turns out people feel similarly strongly about David Miliband. Like, I got told multiple stories about the fact of, like, he could have done better. He could have won that leadership election in, how long ago is it now?
2010.
Because it still had the Electoral College MPs effectively had a golden share. If he just won over a few more MPs by being nice to them, and the strong feeling is that he threw that election simply by assuming that he was sort of entitled to it and being quite kind of rude to people. And there were lots and lots of stories from lobby journalists of just kind of casual rudeness. And you were like, okay, so probably not Mr. New Centrist Party then.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely did throw that election for a variety of reasons. He wasn't nice enough to the 2010 intake. I don't know why I said intake in such a weird way there, but I did, so we're just going to roll with it, I guess. He did not do what he... Yeah, ultimately, because of how the Electoral College worked, neither Ed Balls or Yvette Cooper voted for anyone other than Ed Balls. If David Miliband had phoned Ed Balls up and said, I will make you Shadow Chancellor, I mean, weirdly, what, because this thing, imagine David Miliband became Labour leader. What would he have had to do? He would have had to make Ed Ball Shadow Chancellor, and then he would have had to give Yvette Cooper her pick of Shadow Home or Shadow Foreign.
Otherwise, that would have been an awkward evening in the Balls Cooper household.
However, he could have... It's one of those things where just like...
If you were going to have to do that anyway if they placed highly in the ballot. So why not offer it them in advance?
So you could have offered it in advance because, as happened, we forget, then obviously in 2010, when Ed Miliband became leader, he did not make Ed Balls
Shadow
Chancellor.
He had a crack at making poor Alan Johnson, who really was not up for it.
And did not give Yvette Cooper her choice of posts and instead shunted her off to Shadow Foreign, where she got a bit lost for a year.
She really pulled it back when she moved to Shadow Home, because she stopped her opponent so effectively that that person never was heard of again.
Wow, damn, that was... I can't believe I just witnessed a drive-by shooting. I think then there are... Yeah, well, as I know this has sort of become my sort of life, but ultimately, I do not understand why so many people in politics do not understand that if you cannot win your selection...
You can't win an election.
You can't win an election.
That rhymes.
It is literally just like you have to pass the practical as well as the written exam.
This is like the Bernie would have won thing. Well, he didn't.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where also... And also, in both cases, I mean... It's odd because you have like two groups of people on both sides of the Atlantic, both of whom believe they don't have that much in common, despite the fact that from a policy position that gets quite awkward quite quickly. Both of whom, it's just like, no one lied to you about the fact that you have to get a bunch of like early retired public sector workers who like Europe, don't really like America and like fairness to vote for you if you want to be Labour leader. Like, sorry if you failed at that task, but no one tricked you. Ditto, like, you do have to do better among African Americans than Bernie showed any sign of doing throughout that primary. And there's this weird way when people talk about those two elections, then there's this idea that like there's a group of people in authority who need to learn from the process. Now that may tangentially be true, right? You can make lots of fair criticisms about how the institutes of the Democratic Party ran the presidential election. You can make lots of fair criticisms about how the Labour Party under Ed ran the 2015 election. However, neither of those things were why those candidates lost. But the other hilarious thing about David Miliband there are many, many hilarious things about it. One of which is, of course, isn't like running the International Rescue Committee is quite an important job. And this weird way that everyone kind of talks about it, like, you know, like, you know, oh, if only you would come back to instead lose your deposit, you know, in, you know, I don't know. I briefly considered speculating about which MP I believed would die first this parliament. And then I decided I wanted to keep my job.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And someone did a tweet that was saying like, oh no, David Miliband's not going to like come back and lose to Jacob Rees-Mogg in the next election. And I thought, oh God, the horror.
But I think, and then the third problem, of course, is, I mean, there are many, many reasons why a centrist breakaway won't happen. But one of them is you need to have someone who can command, who the others in this alleged group would defer to. Well, why would Yvette Cooper defer to David Miliband? Why would Chuck Ramuna defer to David Miliband? Why would George Osborne defer? Like, just you've just suddenly got this weird thing where it's like, but why would this... Like, I mean, from a journalistic perspective, I think it would be great because they're...
It gave us something to write about.
Well, also, this thing is ultimately intrapartisan beef is the best beef to cover, and it's the beef that people are the most interested in, right? I mean, this is the sad truth, isn't it? People will continually claim that they want to read about the partisan problems of the other side, but actually, people love the kind of vanity of small differences. There would be a hell of a lot of vanity and a hell of a lot of small differences in this putative group. I back it for that.
Yeah, the trouble is, it's mostly about Brexit as it's currently constituted. I don't see that actually people who are trying to glom George Osborne onto David Miliband and Chuka Ramuna and, you know, like, do we not, have we forgotten the concept of austerity? Like, I know that, you know, Labour, particularly under Ed, sort of triangulated towards it. But they were still, you know, they were...
There was still £80 billion worth of fiscal gap between the two of them every year.
Like, and his instincts always are of a small state and of cutting back. And you might argue that the financial crisis just kind of really gave them an excuse and a kind of frame in which to do that. I just don't know how such a fundamental economic difference can be glossed over about the fact that they're both against Brexit.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. It's just like, I mean, one of the other things is people go like, oh, you know, Blair and Major, two people who literally fought an election against one another on quite different... Actually, if you look at those two manifestos, right, like you don't look at these and go, yes, there's a common platform for government here. That's just simply not the case. As well as all of those not inconsiderable problems. The broader thing is it feels that all of these ideas, they know what they're against, Brexit, Corbyn and May. Now, lots of people are against Brexit, Corbyn and May. However, one, that Venn diagram is not a circle.
And also, it's not a Venn diagram that encompasses enough people to get you enough votes to form a government.
Yeah.
So ultimately, what are you... Okay, let's talk about the Lib Dems, Stephen.
Yeah.
How are they getting on? To be honest with you, I don't... Okay, so Joe Swinson sent me a tweet, and I think that might be the only time I've heard from the Lib Dems since January.
So I had a very troubling moment. I've been doing this series, my usual annual series in the run-up to the local elections, of basically I like to set out what I think a good night will be. So then in advance, it when someone spins me, I can then...
Remind myself
yeah. of what I actually believed. Now, I had finished all of these series. I was uploading a Liberal Democrat one, and I went to look for a picture on the Getty Image Archive. And I thought, oh, I need to find a picture of their leader. And I typed Tim Farron.
Aww.
And I think that sums up very well part of the Liberal Democrat problem.
Well, the only newsline I can think of that Vince Cable's got is that one where he said Brexit voters were elderly racists. And it was like one of those things where you're like, eh, I can kind of see that's for a very small number of men on Twitter. That is kind of very exciting. But it was going to lead to bad, you know, it was a kind of deliberately oppositional thing to say.
So I think one of the things that... oh God, I'm slightly worried and I'm going to start sounding like a Tim Farron fan account, but I'm just going to push ahead through the awkwardness. One of the things that Tim Farron got right from the beginning of his leadership is, you know, in his victory speech, he basically went, look, the coalition means that we are just never going to be the party that, like, everyone loves and is a bit, you know, we are going to have a different type of voter, and we need to be basically decide there are issues which we are willing to be unpopular with the majority of, because the minority that really cares about these things will be with us, and crucially is bigger than the 10% of the vote we got. And he identified staying in the European Union at the time, housing, refugees, and another one. Now, so I think that...
Is it gay sex?
No, it turned out that being unpopular on gay sex and its sinfulness was not one of the positions they ought to countenance being unpopular on. Although it turned out, of course, that it in fact was a position he thought. But yeah. I think, like, the slight problem that the Liberal Democrats had was that in Tim Farron they had someone who politically had the correct diagnosis of their problem and their solution, but in terms of the things he actually himself believed, it was like if you genetically engineered someone to not be the effective message carrier of that.
You mean
stuff.
You need to, yeah, because Brexit is so bound up with social liberalism that it was just very hard to mash those two things. Yeah, somebody who was quite hardline Christian with an anti-Brexit message.
And I think the thing is, I think the Brexit is, you know, the result of angry racists is fine if you're going to say it every week and you're a party whose aim is to get 15, 20% of the vote. The problem was, he said it once, and a lot of the time he kind of gravitates back to the Vince Cable comfort zone of kind of standing slightly sideways to the Labour Party, going, "Isn't it a shame that they're not as nice?" But ultimately, that position I don't think is very lucrative when Labour are in an opposition. Full stop. It's certainly not lucrative when Labour are in an opposition and they're being led from Labour's left flank. It's just a dead end. And also, you know, there has been, I think, a kind of, it seems to me from the outside, an almost conscious effort to unlearn the things about the back of house Lib Dem operation that made it very effective. You know,
you're going back to the sort of Charles Kennedy donut strategy and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but you know, just kind
well,
of...
No, I'm not thinking of the donut strategy. So the donut strategy was the London mayoral thing, right? Which was the difference between inner and outer London. The Charles Kennedy thing was about you kind of fortresses, right? You kind of build up a council level and then you have an activist base that helps you then win an MP.
Yeah, and I think...
I was just thinking about donuts because I had a donut. And you had half a donut, so everyone's
I did.
Happy.
I retrieved it from the bin, in its box.
That is literally a true thing.
I mean, it had been... They hadn't bitten it in half. I cannot believe you threw away that donut without my consent. Anyway, moving on from donut strategies and donuts in general, the problem that the Lib Dems sort of have is that they have... taken away kind of, yeah, they used to have a very fast, often very funny press department. If you are the Lib Dems,
I miss
the only way that
tweets.
Yeah, the only way that you are going to to get your quote in as well as the Labour Party, because they are the official opposition, is A, if your quote arrives first, and B, if your quote is funnier than, is not, I was about to say funnier than the Labour Party. That's actually not true. It has to be objectively funny, because, like, you know, if you think about it, right, if you're writing a piece about any kind of, like, big divide in politics, you obviously do the big two parties, and then if it's Scottish or Welsh, and you do the two nationalist parties. But the Lib Dems, because of their current size, have really got to fight for every inch of space. They had a great setup for that. A lot of people left, yes, because they wanted to move on, but I think also partly, not I think also definitely in some cases, because they just weren't made to feel like it was worthwhile them staying on. There's been an awful lot of kind of quiet dismantling of a very effective operation. But now they've got this kind of problem, and they're sort of stuffed every which way, because if Vince Cable were to leave or to get a grip, that machine wouldn't re-emerge overnight.
But I just think that all of this, I think you're right about the kind of when Labour being led from its left flank and the effect of that. But doesn't that make the only question that's interesting to ask about the next election is how, you know, where do the Blairites go? How bad does a Blairite have to feel about the Labour Party that they will jump to the Conservative Party? That's a big psychological barrier. I just think that's kind of fascinating to me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that, I don't know. The question is the third of the Labour vote, which has doubts, or, you know, is some degree of agnostic about Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister, are they Blairites?
I know. I can't believe I use the word Blairite when I've had a go at people of using the word Blairite. Yeah. That's hypocrisy on my part. But you know what I mean? What I mean is Labour's right, Labour's old right. Or even in terms of voters, people who are swing voters, who are, yeah, I just, how big is that caucus and how much can that affect the next election, I think is my biggest question. Because I feel like the Lib Dems don't feel like a none-of-the-above party at the moment. That's the point about it, right? They're not the kind of receptacle for people who know they ought to vote, but don't really know how to.
Well, the thing is, I think, so that the known unknown about the next election is, yeah, that third of the Labour vote, which doesn't like Corbyn very much. Will they vote Labour again next time because they want the Tories out? Will they vote for the Tories because they don't want Corbyn to be Prime Minister? Will they decide that the following question is too difficult and stay home? Will they vote for the Lib Dems? Now, the kind of ace in the Tory hole is, provided the answer to that question is all of those four, then they are probably fine. That is probably a good backup plan. Labour kind of need the answer to be the first. However, the Tories, I don't think, are really doing any of the things you would want to do to ensure that it isn't the first. You know, then those people don't decide, well, I have doubts about him, but I really don't like that, or whatever that is led by. But I do think that's also part of the Lib Dems' problem. If you have two parties which inspire, yes, affection, but also fear, real fear on both sides, right?
Yeah.
It's never safe to vote for someone else. Those three circles of not liking Brexit, not liking Corbyn, not liking May. There are people who would say they agreed with all three of those. Very few of them, however, when you put a gun to their head, do not have an opinion. Yeah, this is the other thing I've been doing while you've been gone, just
holding
random people up and just being like, honestly, Corbyn or May, pick. And
the Fox thing I now, bitch.
And the thing I've discovered when you put a gun to someone's head and ask them which one of Corbyn and May is better Prime Minister is, two, they start crying and beg you they don't even have a family. But the second thing is that they will ultimately come the crunch, pick one of Corbyn or May.
Yeah. I can see that. That's the thing, is I just think it's a kind of a problem we need to kind of look in the face, really, because you just have all these jokes about, you know, basically drunken men accidentally founding centrist parties, and there is a lot of energy there.
Is it a joke if it happened?
It's more of a joke if it happened, I think. But there is clearly a lot of energy there, and I'm kind of interested in... But then this is the kind of my problem with modern politics anyway, right? It's a kind of amorphous rage rather than, you know, that, like, there are definitely things, if you think Brexit's a bad idea, that you can do that don't involve founding a centrist party. And, like, I wrote a column once about feminism, about men's contribution to feminism. I'm like, men always want to turn up and kind of have opinions. Why am I not allowed to have opinions on it? And you're like, best thing that men could do for feminism is to do more unpaid caring labour. But that's not what people want, is it? In the same way that you could just, you know, help fund a legal challenge, you could do any number of kind of campaigning things in your local area. But what people want is to have a bit of a shout. And I, you know, sympathise with that, because I love having a bit of a shout. But I'm not going to found a new centrist party.
Yet.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-presenter, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not sign up for Stephen's morning email now that the sign-up form works again? You can find it from his Twitter feed, he's always tweeting about it, or there are sign-up boxes under the Stamfirst on almost every piece on our website.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Trust in politics is broken, so can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.